The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm pleased to see all of you here this evening. When I clicked on Amazon.com this morning to look for a brief blurb about our guest's new book, I was surprised to see that the title had jumped to the top of the list. I shouldn't have been. It's getting to be a habit for our native son. As the longtime host of MSNBC's popular news and commentary program, Hardball, Chris Matthews is one of the country's most familiar and trusted voices. A former syndicated columnist, Washington bureau chief, staffer for Democrat members of Congress, and speechwriter during the Carter administration, Matthews has penned many books, including Now Let Me Tell You What I Really Think, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked, and Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, which was critically praised and spent a dozen weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Matthews' latest book, Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, examines the underdog brother who, though overlooked and overshadowed, came to represent hope and idealism for a generation of young Americans. Please welcome back Chris Matthews.
What do you want? Got some bossy photogs here. How you doing? Hi, I got my relatives here. Amon's here. Teresa, Kathy. Thank you all. When are you going to finish? Guys, come on, get out of here. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Hey, it's great. This is a nice, cozy room. And I want to give you a little to place me here in Philly, besides my voice. There is a Philadelphia accent, actually. It's a secret, but we got one. In fact, my Wikipedia page, first line, known for his Philadelphia accent. I'll never get over that one. Anyway, my father, our father, my brothers are here. Is Herb here? Is Charlie here? Hi, Charlie. Okay. Our dad used to work right next door at the courthouse. 30 years, he was the dean of the court reporters. And he used to work at 18th Street. So I'm going out to 18th Street today. And this building here, of course, is the Free Library. I used to come here in high school looking for stuff for school papers and trying to get something done, not too successfully usually. And there's Charlie right there. But it's interesting about the architecture of this building. You know, it was done by an African-American guy named Julian Abel. And he also designed the art museum. He designed the castle, what we used to call, wonderfully, Beaver College. Remember that place? I don't know why they changed that name anyway. That was a great name. You know, anyway, I think he did a bunch of other great stuff, like incredible Gothic architecture at Duke, or as they say down there, Duke. He did that too, amazing guy. And so here we are. If you ever go to Paris, which I've been there, I remember going to Paris the first time and seeing on the Place de la Concorde, there are two buildings that are exactly like these two buildings, exactly like them. And there's the Crillon Hotel, which was the Nazi headquarters during the occupation, beautiful place actually. And right next door to it is the Naval Ministry. They're exactly like these two buildings. So you see and you go, I've seen these buildings before. I'm from Philly. So I want to talk about I worked in politics for years before I get into the journalism thing, and I worked as my first job when I got out of the Peace Corps in Africa was to go look for a job. The Peace Corps is great. It still is. And I was over there riding around a motorcycle being the bourgeois Che Guevara. That's what I was. He was pushing communism. I was pushing capitalism, I guess, free enterprise. That's the way I looked at it. So I got back here, I didn't know anybody, started knocking on doors. I think I went to 200 members of Congress looking for a door to open for me, and I finally got a job with a wonderful liberal Democratic senator from Utah, Frank Moss, who was great. And and the job he gave me was, you can work in the office for free, writing speeches, little speeches, answering complicated mail, and then at night to pay for the job, you have to be a cop. So I was a Capitol policeman. You know who did this? Harry Reid did this. Mike Barnicle did this. A bunch of us did this. That's the way you got started in politics. You were a cop with a gun, a 38. I was armed. It was frightening. The only thing dangerous I did was walk out in the street. Somebody might have thought I was a real cop. The bad guys may have thought it, and the people that needed me may have thought it. Either way, I'd have been in trouble. But so I learned a couple things being a cop in the Capitol. And I think I remember, I think they're more important than a lot of things I learned in politics or in journalism. I used to work with a lot of West Virginia guys, real country boys, regular people. They were used, a lot of them were MPs before they'd come back to get their second job. We were making about $8,000 a year. This was their second job. Of course, that was real money back in the 70s. And one of these guys, Leroy Taylor, he was a white guy, country boy, Leroy Taylor, he told me, he wanted to tell me what I was missing as a college kid from the working guy. So he called me aside one day and he said, you know why the little guy loves his country? I said, no. He said, because it's all he's got. I've never forgotten that. And you get that in your gut, and you'll be smarter than most of the political people in the country, and you'll understand gut patriotism. And if you don't understand it, you shouldn't be in politics, because that's what it's all about, how much love you have for the country. So I learned something else, too. One of the guys I hung out with was a building engineer. He was the super, the guy that would fix anything that went wrong in the middle of the night. And we spent a lot of time together. I wasn't really fighting bad guys every night. It was a pretty safe job. I did have my 38 special, but I didn't have to use it. They only gave us 5 bullets in case we tripped. It's true. So I'm hanging around with him in my uniform at night, enjoying life. And we used to sit near the subway that comes over the Capitol from the Senate building. And would watch, and he'd be reminiscing about the senators, the big shot senators that would come by. And he said, you know, of all the Democratic liberal senators, who you'd think would be all good guys, only one of them ever said hello to the cops. He said hello every day, always made a point of it. And that was Bobby Kennedy. And that got me right off the bat, because I always thought of Bobby Kennedy as being the friend of minorities, a good liberal. He didn't look at it that way. He looked at the liberals and cops shouldn't be at war with each other, that law and justice should go hand in hand. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But it grabbed me. He also wasn't a snooty liberal like a lot of them are, whether it's Fulbright or Ribicoff. They walk around with their nose in the air. They like everybody in general, but nobody in particular. Bobby was, and my old boss, Tip O'Neill, by the way, I worked for as his top guy for 6 years. He was like that, too. He cared about regular people who were sick or they couldn't afford college or whatever. Any problem, he cared about. He was a good guy, a good liberal, a best sign. So I wanted to write this book about Bobby Kennedy. And I wanted to find out some answers to questions I had about him. I couldn't figure out how a guy who everybody said was ruthless, who was his brother's enforcer, also seemed to be the guy that seemed to be the one with the heart. I said, how'd that work out? I think Arthur Schlesinger, he wrote a biography of Bobby years ago, had it right, because he really knew the guy. And he said, you know, Jack Kennedy was a realist pretending to be a romantic. And Bobby was a romantic pretending to be a realist. And the tough, toughest nails people like Kenny O'Donnell, who I got his oral history from his daughter, who transcribed it for me, 64 tapes, of what it was like to be Bobby's roommate in college, a fellow football player at Harvard, and all the way through with him. In fact, he was the one that got Bobby to go work for his brother and run that first campaign. He talked about Bobby being the tough one, it seemed, but he was the one with the heart. And Jack could be very cold, very, very charming and very cold. And so I started beginning to figure out this guy. And I was fascinated with him. I think he was very religious in a very regular way. He was an older boy. He did all the Latin masses like I did growing up, and our brothers did. And he was a regular go-to-church Catholic. In fact, when he was in his teens, if he went to a church, there's no altar boy, he'd run up on the altar and be an altar boy, which most people would be incredibly embarrassed by. You know, Pat Monahan used to serve mass at St. Patrick's down in Washington to the end. Isn't that funny? Patrick Monahan, the senator from New York, he was an old altar boy. But I also discovered that by the end of his life, Bobby Kennedy had gotten into real radical Catholicism. He loved Dorothy Day and Cesar Chavez, and he was trying to figure out what motivated, what religion what religious spirit motivated people that would get out every day and organize farm workers, who would be throughout the day working with the poor in New York and the Bowery. What makes people combine religion with good works? What drives them every morning to do something good that day and to commit their lives to something good? And so I was fascinated with that. And also, somehow, Bobby decided to expose himself to the troubles of the world, almost taking his skin off and walking into rooms. He would, during the civil rights struggle in 1963, he had done a lot of good things secretly. He and Harry Belafonte, who was a real good man of the left, would raise money with the union leaders to get those kids out of jail who were imprisoned during the riots in Birmingham when the police were using their water cannons to destroy them. The police dogs were biting kids. And the country was aroused to do something at that very moment. And Bobby goes up to New York and has James Baldwin put together a bunch of African-American intellectuals, the woman who wrote Raising the Sun and people like that. And they killed him for like 3 hours. In fact, one young guy said, I'm not going to fight for this country because we're not equal. I don't have anything against those people in Vietnam. And Bobby couldn't believe it. He was such a gut patriot. He sort of ended the meeting. I can't take this anymore. Somebody won't fight for their country. It doesn't make any sense to me. And a week or so later, he's the one that's in the room with his brother. And I've got the tape who got him to come out for the civil rights bill. He got Jack to do it. He said, you got to go on television. You have to do it now. No more waiting. We've waited 100 years. You got to do it. And of course, Dr. King's working on the outside. He's working on the inside. And so I began to figure out how he exposed himself. He went down to Appalachia to actually all the way down to the Mississippi Delta. And he sees people with not enough money. The reason they went down there, he and Joe Clark, our great senator from Pennsylvania. Remember him? Joe Clark was great. And only a few hands clapping, but he was great. And he was a great liberal. And Joe Clark, and he went down to, he got beat on the gun issue. Let's never forget why he lost. Schweiker beat him for being, Schweiker was pro-gun. And that'll kill you in Pennsylvania. I mean, Bobby Casey has to be careful of that baby. And this is a gun state. And he goes down there and he sees how poor people are. They can't even afford food stamps. And the kids have distended stomachs. I saw a lot of this in the Peace Corps in Africa. And I tell you, when you see kids that can't, all the kids were eating was molasses all day long. Anything they could find, just enough sugar to stay, keep walking, and dying. And he gets back to his family, his huge number of kids, and he walks into the dining room. They're all having dinner, and he says, you do not know how lucky you are. He was constantly exposing himself to reality and being a better person for it. He wasn't this Groundhog's Day performer that's going on now in the White House every day. You know, every day is the same guy, 6:30 in the morning, you know, operating off his id. Learning nothing, saying nothing of importance, and it just goes on and on. And Bobby tried to learn. And I think Arthur Schlesinger again said, politics is, I heard him say in a group I was with, he said, politics is essentially a learning career. You have to learn every day, like a dentist has to keep up with the manuals, doctors have to keep up with the medicine. Politicians should learn every day what people's problems are and educating themselves to the world they live in all the time. That's what they should be paid to do. They should be representing people, and you can't represent people unless you study them. It's rare. But anyway, I'm not going to give you this book for free tonight, okay? I'm not giving it away. There are some stories in there that everybody here will be fascinated with. The Joe McCarthy stuff will grab you. It may bother you, but it's real. It's the conflict between a young guy who discovers that the guy he loves is wrong. In fact, he's bad. But yet he sticks with him, even when he writes the resolution condemning him. It's very Irish, this story. It is very Irish. It is something else. A kid who loves his father, but his father has no time for him, who ignores him, calls him a runt to his face, and spends all his time with the ones that were chosen. He's the Irish kid that doesn't get the land. And that's my theory, that that's why he cared about little people, because he was one. He wasn't just at the little kid's table. He was treated forever like that until he proved to his father he could be a tough SOB. And only then did his father start paying attention to him when he became his ramrod for his brother's campaign and got him elected senator, then got elected president. Bobby did it all. When you read this book, you realize what an incredible inside guy he was. And yet he had a conscience. And his brother would constantly get into trouble, you know. It's like a great line in one of my favorite movies, History of Violence. He says, Joey, you caused me a lot of trouble. And he's always getting his brother Jack out of trouble. So Jack's, of course, having an affair with Judy Campbell, who just happens to be the Godfather's girlfriend, Sam Giancana. And, of course, they all know it. And Giancana knows it. Sinatra knows it. Everybody knows it. But Jack seems to think it's quite cool that he's hanging around with her. And then J. Edgar Hoover, of course, is sniffing around, and he finds out they've had 70 phone calls. And Bobby doesn't like interfering with his brother's personal life, so he gets his top aide to go send a message over to Jack. You got to kill this thing. You got to end it. And because Hoover's on the trail, and the mob's on the trail. And here's the tricky part. Giancana had contributed to the Kennedy campaign in West Virginia. Tricky. Another sociometric overlay. Giancana was being used by the CIA to kill Castro. So all this is going on while Bobby's spending his life from 1957 as when he set up the Rackets Committee going after these guys from Hoffa to Beck to these guys. And Kierdorf, this Kierdorf's a really interesting guy. He's an arsonist that Bobby's after. Now, Kierdorf blows himself, burns himself practically to a crisp in one of his little operations. And he's a Catholic gentleman. And the policeman who has him on his last legs, he goes over to see him in his deathbed. He says, you're going to meet your maker soon. Why don't you come clean? To which Kierdorf said, fuck you. These are the kind of guys he was dealing with. Like the guys in Casino, the guys with the head in the vice. He's a tough Irishman, this guy with his head, you know. Do him a favor, you know, slit his throat. And these guys, Johnny Dio threw the acid in the face of Victor Rizzell, the labor lawyer. My dad told me about him growing up. He loved Victor Rizzell because he had the guts to take these guys on. So Bobby's doing this for a living. Then he gets to be head of attorney general. And he asks for a list of, they remember Appalachia when they found all the mob meeting up there in New York. And they say, hey, these guys all know each other. Hey, there's such a thing as a mafia. Hey, somebody should tell J. Edgar Hoover, who's still chasing communists, that the bigger problem is organized crime in this country. So Bobby asks for a list of every single one of the hoods. He has a plan. He wants a plan for getting every one of them, including Giancana, who put people on meat hooks. That was his thing, just like in On the Waterfront. That was what he did. And remember, Lee J. Cobb played that guy, Johnny Friendly, which he wasn't. And anyway, he's doing all this at the same time. The Kennedy family is taking money from Giancana. Jack's messing with the girlfriend. It's very complicated. And the CIA is using him to go after Castro. Meanwhile, Bobby's going after Castro and Giancana. Bobby's the good guy. And he's got to deal with all this stuff as Attorney General. So it's great stuff. In fact, Mortimer Kaplan is a professor. He was a professor of tax law at UVA Law. When Bobby went there, he's still alive, this guy. He's 102. He practices law at Thomas Circle in D.C. He has a nice bow tie. Every day he goes to work. He's 102. The guy is the guy who put away the mob guys using income tax information. And he told me, yeah, that's what I was doing. I was glad to do it. It's all in the book, all on the record. And that's how they're probably going to get our man. Yeah. I'm just guessing. Anyway, one thing I notice about this guy, Mueller, he always has no hair out of place. You know, his resume is blue perfect, St. Paul's, and he doesn't have I don't think he has one of those terrible, Romney accents that John Kerry has too, but anyway, that's my prejudice. Anyway, but he carries around that attaché case like it's got gold in it. He's always leaning over to hold it. Like, if I were the president, I'd say, what has he got in that box? He's like, oh, my God, he's coming after me. He's like Columbo, you know, just one more question. Just one more. Sorry to bother you. One more. So the good stuff in this book is about, I'm teasing here, by the way, there is books for sale afterwards. Don't be a, as we union people, and I'm in SAG, don't be a free rider, okay, here. Jimmy Hoffa, Lyndon Johnson, hated Lyndon Johnson. Good reason. Okay, here's a good story. I got this from Robert Carra, who's devoted his life to doing everything that Lyndon Johnson ever did. It turns out, and this came out in the latest edition, I was able to get this in time. In 1953, Bobby's having breakfast with D. Joseph McCarthy and the other people, Roy Cohn and the rest, David Shine, and I'll get into that if you want. And Johnson comes by. He's just been elected the Democratic majority leader of the Senate. And he does this ministerial shake hands with everybody. They always have to kiss his butt. And he comes by, and Bobby tries to ignore him. And Johnson, I know this from knowing Larry King, the writer, you didn't ignore Lyndon. He sensed like a radar. Who's not giving me my respect here? So he goes up to Bobby and keeps saying, shake my hand, young man. And Bobby finally gives him a fish, you know, okay, here, you know. And he walks, and Johnson walks away, and George Reed is his press secretary, and he goes, and Reedy says, what was that? He says, oh. Johnson says, this is 1953. He says, well, that's from 1940. 1940 it started. Johnson was an acolyte of FDR, a little, you know, eager beaver that wants to be a big New Dealer. And so they're in the White House, and it turns out that he gets a call from Joe Kennedy. He's coming back from England. He's ambassador. Of course, he's not in good terms with Roosevelt, but he's in better terms with Hitler, actually. Just kidding. Anyway, and certainly with Chamberlain. And while they're sitting there, he's saying to Joe, welcome back, Joe. Come on to the White House. You bring Rose. We're going to have a great dinner tonight. You come right here. And then he whispers to LBJ, I'm going to fire the bastard. So Johnson dines out on that for decades. And in Washington, you finally hear who doesn't like you. The word does get around. I've learned that. You badmouth somebody, one night it gets around. They know about it. And your relationship is cold, if not dead. And so Bobby was heard about this. And Johnson realized he heard about this. And this relation just got worse and worse. When Johnson ran against Kennedy in 1960 for the Democratic nomination, he went out publicly and spread the word that the old man Kennedy was a Nazi, and that Bob and Jack was dying of Addison's disease. Well, he had Addison's disease, he wasn't dying, but he said he was dying of it. And Bobby really built a pretty good hatred for this guy, but I'll get into that, there's more to that, but it's really Irish stuff. I mean, it's really serious stuff. His relationship with Fidel Castro, he was trying to get rid of him. It's pretty clear what he was up to. They always kept plausible deniability, but were they trying to, wouldn't it bother Bobby one bit if he got up in the morning and learned that Castro was dead? It wouldn't have bothered a bit, but he kept distance from it. He was our Cold War enemy, and I'm not a big Castro guy. Anyway, I want to talk about just a bit before we get to questions, because I think this is something that really motivated me in writing this book. Whatever your politics are, I think you'd agree that we're a better off country when people, working people, regular people who are most of the country, vote consistently. And what happens now because of all these social issues like abortion rights and gay rights and the rest and prayer in school, that the white working class has moved itself away from the black working class. Even though they may make the same money and basically have the same goals for their kids, they vote differently. And what Bobby Kennedy was able to do, not that he got those two communities to love each other, there's no kumbaya going on, but he could unite them in common purpose. He could be trusted by both of them. And if you look at this book, if you buy it tonight, and what you'll see in the book is not everything is money. What you'll see on the book is a white, really a poor family. You can see the guy was probably an enlisted guy in the Navy or the Army. He's a swabby or whatever, a grunt. And he's got sweatshirts on. And he's got just beat up. He looks like he's had a hard day of working on Saturday. His kid's next to him with no shirt on. We didn't wear shirts when we were kids either. Dirty. Both saluting Bobby's train. Saluting a guy as a patriot. Not some pal or an elected official, but as a patriot. That's gone. And then the African Americans who got it down, I just heard a story about them and the awful sound that came over. Somebody here told me about this. They came over the crowd at 30th Street Station when the train went by, the funeral train. And in Baltimore, there's like thousands of people singing spontaneously the Battle Hymn of the Republic, African Americans. That kind of trust, belief in of both communities in the same person is gone. Reagan started to take away part of that people, like the working people, then with the Reagan Democrats, and then Trump has brilliantly exploited the differences over social issues. Now, what I love about this book is it shows that people can actually join together and actually be a united country again at the bottom and the economic middle of the country. And it is really powerful. In fact, in the book, I show pictures of both communities on the same page, lining up in a desperation over the loss of this guy. And I just want people to know that the spirit of Bobby Kennedy is still there out in the country. There are people that can do this. They're not visible right now. I have a hard time finding out who the leaders of the country are. That I think the Democratic Party is not doing anything right now. I don't know what they're doing. I watched Nancy and Chuck the other day reading stupid staff-written crap about the tax bill. This is a Ponzi scheme. Okay, that's some staff, 20-year-old, wrote that, and they come out and they can't even read it. They stumble over it. They don't even go to work in the morning, the Democrats, anymore. I don't know what they're doing. They should have inspired plans, damn it. They should be for something, you know? And and the Republicans are acting like North Koreans. They march around. They smile at the right time. They're frightening. They might as well wear those big hats. I mean, they're ridiculous. They just, whatever he says they're for. Oh, well, I was for free trade last year, but now I'm for against free trade because he says so. Republicans, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. I don't understand it. How can 80% of the people be for something they weren't for last year? Because, you know why they call themselves conservatives? Well, I'm a Republican and I'm a conservative, so I'm a conservative. No, it doesn't go the other. The other conservatives, so they become Republicans. They become Republicans, so they say they're conservatives because they're supposed to be a conservative, you're a Republican. They don't even know what it means. I'm sorry. So we have two pretty parties out there. And it's a problem. And I'd like to see somebody with some spirit. I personally think the old politics makes more sense. Work and wages, I think the idea of economics and getting the bottom up is the key. Not just through minimum wage and things like that, but actually giving people real jobs. I think the public sector is dead. I think that anybody been on Amtrak lately? I'm sorry. I'm going to be on it tonight. I was on it today. My wife and I have been lucky to see much of the world. We've seen China, Japan, Europe, fastest trains in the world. They go 300 miles an hour, and your little Diet Coke doesn't move a rattle. It just sits there in front of you, and you're going 300 miles an hour. And these are what we used to call third world countries. We should have this country united by train. I want to have Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint taking the 20th century again through that tunnel. All right, that's what I want to see. I want to see this country united by rail. Lincoln started to do it during the Civil War when he created land-grant colleges and scientific agriculture, all during the Civil War. They built the Empire State Building in the middle of the Great Depression. Why don't we do anything anymore? Instead of giving huge tax cuts to the rich, we ought to be building something. That's what I believe in. And I think that, and the labor unions are asleep. I don't know why the construction trades aren't banging on the door of Chuck and Nancy and saying, stop just pissing around about it, we don't like your tax cut, to being for something. And I do think this country, with the interest rates as low as they are now, could really build right now at low interest rates and really create a really opportunity for the service, for the building trades. And the real people that want real jobs, we could be reunited. This instead of flyover country where the elite fly from New York and they look down on these little circles. They don't know what they are. What are those things down there? They'd actually recognize that America's down there in places like St. Louis and Chicago and Cleveland and all those parts of the country. Kansas City would actually be part of the country again. I really want to reunite the country by rail. That's what I want to do. It would put everybody to work. It would stop this elitism of the two coasts, where they vote one way and the rest of the country votes another way. They're living in different worlds because of flight. There's an old joke. An old couple said, where'd you go? Where'd you go on vacation? I don't know, we flew. We don't have any idea where we're flying over anymore. What's that? It's from America. This is something down there. They farm or something. I don't know. Anyway, that's my simple political message. But I really want to talk about anything you want to talk about tonight. And obviously, it's long past time for me to notice that it's on the record. So. By the way, Joe Biden is running for president. It's happening. I know it for a fact. Ask him. He's running. Anyway, I know it. It's a fact. I just said on Channel 10 today and on CAU, and they said they just put it out as a big news story. I don't know. Just ask the guy. I'll tell you. Joe doesn't keep it to himself, does he? No, he's not, does he? He could be the secret. He could be 20, 30 years younger. I had a great joke there. The guy goes to Swami and says, I'd like to have my wife 30 years younger than me. And the guy says, zap, you're 90. No, it's all true. Let's go to questions.
Chris, it's a great book, great pictures in here, and everything's good. But Marilyn,
everything in Washington before the word "but" means nothing.
Okay.
I now listen to what you want to say. Go ahead.
Marilyn Monroe was left out of the book.
Yeah, right. You're right. You got it. You can probably write a book about Marilyn Monroe if you want to.
tell us?
I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
I honestly don't. I didn't investigate it. I'm not interested.
Was it true that something was in the papers?
Obviously, you think.
That came out recently about the Kennedy assassination, yeah, about Marilyn Monroe and Bob.
Yeah, well, there was somebody who was going to write a book along those lines blaming him for her death. I don't believe it. Okay, I think we would have known that by now. Yeah. I think Marilyn Monroe was, well, I think she had a tragic situation of depression, and she was 36. I talked to a movie star that said the night before she died, she was very depressed about being 36. It's hard to believe, but she was. I don't know what happened, but if Kennedy was involved with that, we would know it by now.
Chris, a big fan of Barack Obama. How did he not fulfill the destiny that I thought he was going to have with Bobby Kennedy? How was he not Bobby Kennedy?
Well, he's and I was gung-ho for him. I think he won with incredibly good speech making. In fact, when I heard him in 2004 at Boston, I said right afterwards on the air, you just heard the first African-American president. I knew that. I knew it was coming. And I think he's detached. I think every night he would go upstairs to the White House with his two daughters and his wife and just hang out with them. He didn't want to meet with politicians at night. When he did agree to meet with politicians, he'd meet at a hotel somewhere so he could get out. You know, it's an old Hemingway trick. You know, go meet at the bar so you can leave. Don't invite anybody over because they'll stick around. And he had these tricks to get away from people. He didn't have friends. And we didn't know this when he elected him. I voted for him. But, I mean, I think he was just not a mixer, not a guy that wants to hang out with other politicians. I think he looked down on them. And I think that was a problem we had. I think it's a problem with a lot of liberals. They think they're too elite. I just think they are. I think it's too much self-celebration. You know, he said the right things. He got through Obamacare, and then he never mentioned it again. Reagan was smart. Every time when Reagan would pass a tax cut, he would refer to it as our program in the present tense for 8 years. He was very smart at selling the car after he sold the car. And you got to do that post-selling thing. You have to keep saying over and over again, you know, that thing we got going, those lower taxes, it's good for the country. See, Obamacare was still going on. Why isn't he talking about it? And he would say, well, the opponent spent $200 million trashing it. That's what happened. Well, he should have raised the money to sell it. I just think he was detached. And I liked him. And he was always good. I have nothing against him. He was always good to me for interviews. And I always felt he was personable. You know, you always want to, where's your wife? Let me say hello to her. And one-on-one, he was good. He just, he enjoyed his, like now, since he's been president, I think he enjoys his, maybe not his solitude, but not everybody has the love of it. You know, Al Sharpton, of all the people, you would think he'd be snarky and sort of a wise guy. He loves being in a room like this. He loves walking around meeting regular people. He just likes it. He has it in him. He's been a show business guy, but he likes being with people. In fact, his book is fantastic to listen to in the car. My wife's been listening to it, and I've been listening to it. It's not everybody likes people, you know? And it's just the way it is. And I think you need a politician who likes people. Trump has no ability to be empathetic. He doesn't know how to do it. I mean, there's Bobby Kennedy the night that Dr. King is killed. He goes to a tough black neighborhood in Indianapolis. The cops won't go in with him. He goes in on his own. He stands up on a flatbed truck in front of a bunch of people that obviously aren't too happy with everything in the world. And he goes to the guy next to him. So I got the NBC tape. I found out what was on the tape. And he said, do they know yet? They didn't even know yet. There was no tweeting back then. And so he had to tell them. And if you want to go look at it on YouTube or something, it's just stunning that a white guy can walk in front of a bunch of African Americans and tell them that the hero of their history, of all the history of this country, has just been shot by another white guy and try to explain it. So I think he had that, I think because his brother had been killed and something about him, he had empathy, and I think it's because he allowed himself to have empathy. He wasn't some cold-hearted person, you know, I think they're rare. I think Biden's like that a little bit, and I think some of them I know in politics are like that. They actually listen to people. I'm not sure I'd be good at it. Yes, sir. Why don't you, Miss? Thank you. To pass that in there.
Hi. Can you say a bit about Roy Cohn and Bobby Kennedy,
yeah,
and the arc, if there is one, that led to Trump?
Isn't that something? Let me tell you about the story of Roy Cohn, who was a brilliant young guy, of course. He prosecuted Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. He had a lot to do with that in the back in the worst days of the Cold War on the atomic bomb spying. In fact, by the way, a friend of mine is the cinematographer for Steve Spielberg, Janusz Kaminski. He grew up in communist Poland. You know what high school he went to? Julius and Ethel Rosenberg High School. So he was hired as a young guy. He's very smart. He works for McCarthy. McCarthy loved the guy. I can't quite figure. He doesn't seem lovable to me, but McCarthy loved the guy. And of course, he loved David Shine. I'm not sure he was gay, but I'm not sure what Shine was. And it's just a very infatuation kind of relationship. So that was the really heart of a lot of the trouble. So every time McCarthy loved publicity, it was like besides his booze, it was his booze. Okay, and he loved publicity. And Roy had a genius for creating, getting publicity, and he relied on him. And so from 1950 all the way through the end of pretty much the end of 54, McCarthy was riding high. And he was finding enough to keep the thing going, from the promise that they'd find 205 communists in the State Department, that they'd find 70, that they'd find 52, to whatever the number was. He kept it going. And by 1954, or 1953 rather, as I said, Roy Cohn and McCarthy had taken over the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the Senate, which meant they could investigate anything. What did they choose to investigate? The books being distributed by the United States Information Service in Europe, because they were communist books. It was crazy. And then they go after a dentist over in Fort Monmouth, the Army Signal Corps installation there. Some guy named Dr. Perez, who was a member of the Communist Party, but he was a dentist. And then became who promoted Dr. Perez, and that was Zwicker. And all the time he's fighting with the Army. And McCarthy's just going crazy. He's drunk all the time, you know? And then finally the country had enough of him when Joe Welch, they hit him with the Have You No Decency and the big hearings. Lyndon Johnson hated McCarthy, made sure those hearings were televised. ABC decided to televise them gavel to gavel. And that created ABC News. Because other networks weren't doing that kind of coverage. My mom, of course, is home with our first Admiral TV, Charlie, and mom's watching the hearings. And she wasn't rooting for the Army. Mary Shields was keen on McCarthy. My father was like most people. He said, this guy went way too far. But McCarthy had his back, he had his following, and he ended up destroying himself. And then for the 3 years, and it turned out Bobby was with him, but Bobby did some good work for him. He wasn't doing the junk. In fact, if you read the book, there's parts in it where Bobby was actually, he was the one that discovered that the British, in the middle of the Korean War, when we're fighting the Chinese, are sending strategic materials, oil and everything else, to the Chinese. And they've got their own soldiers in the field against the Chinese army, the Red Army. So he discovered that, and a liberal columnist said it was the only thing good McCarthy ever did was expose that. And then Bobby breaks with McCarthy, sees it's going to hell in a handbasket, he quits. But then the Democrats get to pick a minority council in early 1954, and they pick Bobby. John McClellan of Arkansas picks Bobby. So Bobby's at war with McCarthy the second year. So 1 year with him, 1 year against him, and he ends up writing the resolution condemning him for the Democrats. So he has to break with him. That said, well, he also hated Roy Cohn. And the right-wingers in the country, a lot of them Irish, I got in the book up in Boston at a bar, the political bar, and they're all rooting for Roy Cohn, who's Jewish, but they're all Irish, against Bobby, because Bobby's not anti-communist enough. And Roy Cohn is their hero. So it was really interesting what happened back then. And McCarthy gets censured by the United States Senate. Jack Kennedy's in the hospital. He dodges the vote. Bobby doesn't want any trouble with that. They do not want to vote against McCarthy up in Massachusetts, where he's the most popular in the country. That's his most popular state. McCarthy's finished, destroyed, he's censured, he begins the gradual process of drinking himself to death, which he succeeded in doing in 1957. And Bobby's with his daughter Caroline, or not, Kathleen, his oldest daughter. They're at the airport, National Airport in D.C., and he hears over the car radio, Kathleen told me this, that McCarthy had finally done it. He's at the Naval Hospital in Bethesda. He had liquor under the bed, drinking himself to the end, cirrhosis of the liver. He succeeded in his final goal of killing himself. And Bobby had written in his diary, drunk the last three hearings, blah, blah, blah. He'd watched this decline. He'd go visit him, and he'd be in a stupor, and his new wife would actually be the only one that could talk, and Bobby still sat there and was loyal to him personally. And then Bobby gets on the plane. 70 United States senators go to the funeral, 70 in the Capitol. Bobby goes to the funeral out in Appleton, Wisconsin. Bobby goes alone because he's loyal to McCarthy, and he sneaks on the plane. He gets off the plane. He gets a reporter to give him a ride to the gravesite. He says the guy, and the guy didn't give it away for 20 years, don't tell anybody I'm here. And he sat in the car during the burial just out of loyalty to McCarthy. And both brothers, Jack and Teddy, said that was the character of their brother, how loyal he would be to a guy that he helped condemn. But he was loyal to him personally. That's Bobby. And so Roy Cohn is Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn brilliantly said, 100 years ago, no matter what I do the rest of my life, and he did a lot of awful stuff, the first paragraph of my obituary in the New York Times will be, was counsel to Joe McCarthy. And it was. But Cohn was a strange guy. I once saw him when Reagan was speaking in the Capitol, in the House, and I looked up, I saw Roy Cohn sitting up there. So I immediately had some power. In those days, I had some power, and I went to see the Sergeant-at-Arms. I said, who paid for that seat? Who put him up there? And it was Mario Biaggi from New York. It was just interesting, that's all. I always like to get these connections. Anyway, he's your guy. Yes, and Trump likes the guy. He's one of Trump's one of his proteges. You can figure that one out pretty soon.
First, I want to say that I think Hardball is the best television show on TV.
Thank you.
I've heard you say a few times that you wouldn't run for an elected office.
Yeah.
Let's suppose Biden gets in or another Democrat. Would you want to be in the cabinet, one of the secretaries?
You know, I'm sure if the right guy, and I had got too old to do TV, if the right guy said, you want to run the Peace Corps, I'd say, yeah. You know, I don't think Trump knows there is a Peace Corps, but he never joined, that's for sure. I'm sure I'm up for public service. I don't want to give up what I do because I love what I do. And it's just what I was born to do. Yeah, in the back, we'll just work around the room with everybody. No, it's a, you know, I'd be the kind of, if I'd ever ran for the Senate up here and had managed to beat, first of all, I didn't want to run against Arlen Specter. I liked him. I didn't love him. I said he was okay. But I thought I wouldn't want to hurt him any, attack him, but he'd want to attack me. So I said, I'm not getting in that race. Arnold Schwarzenegger once said to me, there's only two reasons to run for public office. One, you think what you're doing now is worthless, and two, you want to kill the other guy. And I don't want to kill the other guy. It's not interesting to me to do that sort of thing.
Chris,
who
do you think is the Democrat in 2020 to step up? Is it Joe Biden or who's out
well,
there?
Well, let me just say again, you can always tell who might win. That's somebody who's running. And all the people, who are the Democrats going to run next year? Well, the Democrats don't run anybody. Somebody runs and runs and they use the Democratic process to get elected. Bernie wasn't even a Democrat. He almost won. He just used the process. That's what they do. So you pick yourself. It's like in student council. Remember you're growing up in school, and somebody comes up to you and says, you know, some guys got together and thought I ought to run. No, they didn't. Yeah, you want to run. Nobody got together. You're a politician already. You want to be famous. You want to go to law school. You want it on your resume. Screw you. And that's what politicians are. Some guys get together and thought I ought to run. No, they didn't. Look, who do I like? I'll tell you what I like. I'm a little wary of Corey. A little wary of him. I'm not sure about how much is there. Good interview, Rhodes Scholar, but I want to see a little more. I'm sort of impressed with Kamala Harris out west. I think some. The ones I like personally, I love Amy Klobuchar. I think she's great. I like Kirsten Gillibrand. I don't know why she, huh? Yeah, but he lost. You're not going to be president after getting beaten in the Senate race to Roy Blunt. I'm sorry. You guys got to work your way up, you know. Yeah, I hear good things about him. I hear this guy in Montana's pretty good, so I think maybe when I learn his name, I'll really be impressed. But I know he's running. I hear Andrew wants to run. Andrew Cuomo wants to run. I don't see it. Okay, keep it up. You might make it. I love Mario. Mario was charming. He looked like Yves Montand. He was great. But I don't know. I don't know about Andrew. But he wants to run. I thought Chris Murphy up in Connecticut might run. I thought, and he might. My candidate for Hillary's running mate, and I will stand on this, I think if she'd run a different kind of campaign, beginning with picking the right VP, she would have won. It wasn't that hard a thing to win. If she had picked a guy with the right kind of gravelly working guy voice, like Sherrod Brown from Ohio, she would have won. Because she had to make a statement, and the statement should have been, I'm with the regular working people. I'm not with the elite. And I see Bill Green's here. Hey, Bill. And Pat. You know, I think like Bill Green. Anyway, you got to be with the regular people. Again, to my old argument, why are you running the elite? And too many Carole King concerts. I'm sorry. And it's just too much of it. Too much of it. Get the guy from Rehoboth. You know, I just think if the Democrats got, a friend of mine in the Peace Corps, he was pretty lucky with women. He would say, women, people, he said, don't mind being used. They mind being discarded. That is godly information. You just can't use a bunch of, Irish, Italian, Polish, Jewish working people, all those people, and then all of a sudden decide you're with somebody else. Oh, we got a new group we like now. And they got the message. Archie Bunker started it. Let's all make fun of the Irish guy in Queens. Let's all make fun of this guy. Let's look down on him. Let's make Meathead the smart guy in the house. Now, they got the message fast. You don't like us? Fine, we'll vote for the other guy. The word's out. Just a thought. Yep. So I want more women. What is this with guys? I want this to stop with the mansplaining here. I mean, I'm not taking any more male questions here. This is what happens in school. It's happening again here with a mature audience. Women. I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Hey.
That's all right. Thank you,
so,
though.
First of all, thank you for not running against Arlen Specter. I worked for him in college, and I would have been out of a job.
I voted. First guy I ever voted for.
Yeah.
First guy.
And it was great working as a Democrat, working for a Republican. He had narcolepsy. He used to fall asleep at his desk. I could write a fabulous book about him. But anyway.
You talk faster than I do.
So I'm a playwright, and I wrote a play about Bobby Kennedy and the speech he gave in Roseburg, Oregon about gun control.
Yeah, I wrote it. It's in the book.
Yeah, it's a very...
Tell us about that speech, because it's great.
So about 10 days before his assassination, he was running for president. This was May 27th, 1968, and he went to Roseburg, Oregon to give a speech. Now, according to my research, which it's been kind of back and forth. I went to the Kennedy Library. Richard Goodwin had written a speech for him that was supposed to be with talking points on Vietnam, but he shows up at the courthouse in Roseburg, Oregon, and there's all these very working class people and
lumberjacks.
John Birch Society people.
Well, they were lumberjacks. Yeah. They were all pro-gun guys, yeah.
Yeah, and they had signs that said Second Amendment rights and whatever, and he on the fly gave this amazing speech about how guns shouldn't be in the hands of mentally ill people because, Lee Harvey Oswald had ordered his gun in the mail, and he gave the example of a guy that was on death row in Kansas City. And when
that was a tough story. I have it in the book, but it's still...
I'm still trying to verify it.
Here's a guy on death row who mails away for a rifle.
And he gets it.
and some chowderhead actually... an interesting address, the pen, and he got it. It's crazy.
So I wasn't able to verify it all. I went through all the oral histories. But what I'm wondering, because I used that event to compare it to the school shooting that happened in Roseburg, Oregon on October 1st, 2015. And when I've done a lot of research on Bobby Kennedy. I'm a playwright and I write a lot about him. He's my favorite subject. But one thing I haven't found is a lot of other things where he talked a lot about gun control. And I wonder what you think he would think today of all these shootings, particularly with Las Vegas and Orlando. If he were running for president now or in office now, what do you think he'd be doing about it?
Well... Mm-hmm. I think we've had in our history a scary pattern of political assassination, unlike any other country in the world. I'm not talking Bangladesh, you go to Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe, there's no country in the world like this. In Latin America, there's none. Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley. Teddy Roosevelt had something in his pocket that saved him from the bullet. FDR, Mayor Cermak was killed down at the Orange Bowl. They were aiming at FDR. Harry Truman had the Puerto Rican nationalists try to get him at Blair House. Kennedy was shot dead. Gerry Ford was shot at twice. And Reagan was killed. One was killed. In fact, the only reason he wasn't dead was because Jerry Parr the Secret Service agent, got him to George Washington University Hospital in 3 minutes. He was the real hero of that one. So we live in a weird country. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the Nazi Party, Bobby Kennedy. I mean, George Wallace would have been killed. I mean, he was shot. He was paralyzed. So we live in a strange environment. We also an environment in which mass killing is conducted, too. I wrote this all in the New York Times last week in an op-ed about Roseburg. And, of course, Roseburg, we had the mass shooting there recently. And so, which is evilly ironic. I don't know how we deal with it. I mean, you can deal with the mail order part, because Bobby was really concerned about mail order deliveries of guns, because it seemed almost exotic back then. Now we don't even think about it. I mean, now the fight's over. Can you walk into a bar armed and, you know, open carry? That's crazy, but everybody wants to go into saloons now, like in the Long Branch Saloon with, you know, Kitty Russell. I mean, they want to go in and drink armed. It seems crazy. And the NRA is getting stronger and stronger, and its membership is, I have a brother like this, I know. It's a condition, right, Charlie? We have a brother like this, he lives up in, you're not the brother. who lives up in, you know, up north in the state somewhere. And he wouldn't want me to give away his location because the federal government would know it then. I said, Bruce, why do you have guns? He said, when they come, I'll be ready. He wants a gun, so when they come to take his guns, he'll fight them with the guns. It's a little circular, but it works for Bruce. I'm sorry, I gave his name away. So that's true. I'm glad you said that. Bobby Kennedy is the only time in my life I wrote a congressman. I wrote Eilberg, a congressman I later had to deal with another way. I wrote him and I said, because Bobby died, and Johnny Carson never said a political thing in 30 years, said, write your congressman on guns. And I did it. And I think a lot of people did. Nothing happened, because the gun owners never change their mind. They never think about anything else. And us normal people think about other things. You know, you may be pro-choice or something, or you don't want wars, or you have other interests. But the gun people have one unique, exclusive interest, their guns. And it's hard to beat that crowd. I saw it happen to Joe Clark in 1968. And there were other issues, but that was one that I thought that was what, that in the war, but it killed him. So, this has been a great audience. I really appreciate it. You're nice to come out. And and I do believe that you will love this book. I said tonight on my show that it has my heart. It will have your heart. It's about anybody that knew him. I know a lot of guys know him. Wayne Owens knew him, and guys like Paul Corbin, a tough guy. Ed Guthman knew him. Oh, God, Frank Mankiewicz, Bill Green knew him. All these people knew him personally, all loved the guy. And that always got to me. The people that knew him real close up loved him. The reporters like Richard Harwood thought he was against him in the beginning, and then he fell so in love with the guy with the Washington Post that he said, take me off this beat. I can't be honest anymore. I can't be objective. I love this guy. And Jack Newfield wrote that too. And some of the great reporters loved the guy who knew him. Breslin loved him. And so the people I trust, I wrote this book entirely based on people I knew that knew him. And Guthman, of course, was editor here of the Inquirer for a while. What a good guy, because I fought with him over I was working for Carter, and I once called him up, and I said, why are you giving all this coverage to Teddy Kennedy? He goes, look, I've been where you are, you know, because he'd been a press secretary to Bobby. Anyway, they're the good people I used, and I think you're going to love this book. I think it's got great adventure with the whole Cold War and the fighting the mob. I mean, we had a good guy once. But last question. Yes, dear. Speaking for the women, I mean, like, the second one tonight.
So, what are your predictions for Trump and Pence?
And what?
Trump and Pence.
Pence is sort of waiting, isn't he? He's, like, waiting. Do you ever look at him? He's just waiting. He doesn't, he reminds me, did you ever see the Da Vinci Code? Yeah, he's the one Paul Bettany played, you know? One of those supernumeraries, kind of scary guys, super religious, you know, he's Catholic, but now he's something else, but he goes to both churches. I don't know. I don't think he's evil or anything, but God, he is patient, and he is. I think he's like LBJ. He waited to not so much to help as much as to succeed. Don't you think? Yeah, I think he may be impeachment insurance at some point when people think about it, but because he'll be in for a while if he gets in. I don't think the country would elect a guy like that at all. I think if he has to face the voters, he'll lose. This election in 2020 could go a number of ways. I think Trump has a strategy. I think it is to hold his people. I call it the 38th parallel. The 38%, hold them, because he can ignore New York and California, so it's not really 30, it's in the mid-40s if you take out New York and California. He can hold the number, find the opponent, start attacking them personally. If it's Bernie, he'll call him a socialist. If it's Joe, he'll call him old. He'll call him, something awful. He calls me dumb. Well, I know I'm not, so I don't care. But he called Pocahontas. I mean, this is high school stuff. This is like life at maternity BVM when I was a kid. You know, it's making fun of the kids on the schoolyard. You know, and that's what he does. And he goes, what's it called? Low energy Jeb. Well, actually, he was right about that one. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.